Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to have here with me Mr. Lars Hedegaard, who is chairman of the Free Speech Society of Denmark and various other countries in the world. Mr. Lars Hedegaard is an historian and also a journalist and has been active in the discussion of Islam for quite some time now. He has recently written a book about Islam, and this book is the starting point of the discussion. The agenda will be first to discuss the book and the historical angle on the relationship between Islam and the West, then go on to discuss a little on the psychological and perhaps the political problems of the West, and then end up with a discussion on what to do and why we do it. The relationship between the West and Islam is a very old relationship. Do you see any patterns in this relationship that you could reflect on?
There's a very clear pattern. Our book is called The 1400-Year War. Of course, that is no coincidence. It deals with the relationship not only between Islam and the West, but also between Islam and any other culture, any other religion or civilization. 1400 years ago, the Prophet Muhammad declared war on anyone who would not bow to his totalitarian ideology. He started out intimidating, vanquishing the tribes of the Arabian Peninsula. He waged war on them. He killed any critic he had, anyone who made fun of him, anyone who did not entirely obey his orders. And if you analyze the true content of Islam, it is a war ideology.
War ideology.
Yes, that's what it is. It is a scheme by which the adherents of the Prophet, if he's ever lived, which I doubt, but that's beside the point, he's believed to have lived. And those who wrote down what he said and what he did certainly believed that he was a real historical person, and that's what counts today. If you analyze what his message was, as expressed in the Quran and also in the Hadith, in the commentaries on the Quran, and also in the commentaries on various other things by the ulema, that is, the wise men of Islam, you'll see that the core is really waging war, conquering the world, subjecting anyone in the world to the dictatorship and the supremacy of Islam.
So you would say that waging war is the basic principle of Islam?
Yes, it is. Jihad, waging war, is the basic principle. It does not necessarily need to be war in our sense of the word. That is, a violent war. It was, in the beginning, basically, we had waves of jihad. We had the Arabian jihad, which you could say ended in 732 with the defeat of the Muslims in France, the Battle of Poitiers. That was the first jihad. You could say that there's a second jihad, which is the Turkish jihad, or the Ottoman jihad, which started in the 1080s and ended in front of the gates of Vienna in the late 1600s. And since that time, Islam has not been able to conquer anything, especially not in the West, by means of force. So they have other means. The third jihad, which is the one we are living under today.
So you think right now, today, we are living in a third...
In the third jihad, yes. Okay. Which you can date from precisely 1979 with the Iranian Revolution and various other documents that came out at that time. It is mostly an immigration jihad, as it's been clearly expressed by the spokesman of Islam, We cannot at this day and age vanquish the West by means of arms. We have to overwhelm them by demographic means. That is, you emigrate to the West, you have lots of children, you do not integrate, which is forbidden, of course, and then you gradually take over the West. This, of course, does not mean that we don't have terror. We do have terrorism. We do have bombings, etc. But that is really secondary. It is almost to be seen as a diversionary activity aimed at directing our gaze in the direction that is least important. The most important thing is this massive influx of Muslims to the West.
Do the single Muslim person, do they know that they're part of this plot?
I don't know if they all do, and I don't know if they all of them subscribe to it or want to participate in it. I suspect that a fair number of them do, because that is the content of their religion, which is not really a religion in our sense, but a political ideology. But that is not really the most important point. The most important point here is who has the power over the Ummah, as we say, the nation of Islam, which is not a national thing, it is a transnational, a global thing. Who is the local power holder? That is the important thing, because any Muslim who would not want to deviate from the line, from the order, to conquer the world, of course, is kept down by violent means, threats, intimidation, if need be, murder. And if you analyze the way the local power holders, the imams in the West, and their backers in the Muslim world, the ulema, the so-called learned men of Islam, if you analyze their strategy, which is also, of course, laid down in the basic documents of Islam, you will see that lots of things make sense. People often ask, why don't they want to integrate? Or why is integration not really working? It is not working because it's absolutely forbidden to integrate. A Muslim does not, cannot, must not obey non-Muslim laws if he wants to get into paradise. Why are women controlled all their lives? Why do they need a guardian? First their father, and if he's gone, their cousin or their brothers or other men in the Ummah. Why is that? That's because you need to control their offspring, their reproduction, because any Muslim male is a soldier in the army. Islam is an army. Why do they wear the veil or the hijab? Because they must be separated from the rest of the population. The veil indicates that these women cannot be wooed or approached by non-Muslim men. Why do they keep asking for cultural special rights such as the halal, which, by the way, is not mandated in the Quran? It says specifically in the Quran that Muslims are welcome to eat anything that Jews and Christians eat. So they can eat, according to the Quran, they can eat anything that Christians do, such as pork, shellfish, etc. But why do they keep raising these demands? Why separation of sexes? Why separate swimming pools, curtains? All that stuff is intended to underline the need for Muslims to separate, to be a separate society, a separate culture from the culture they have invaded, so to speak.
Okay. There are other principles that is kind of under the principle of jihad, like the principle of taqiyya, the holy lie. Do you have any reflections on that?
Yes, it's a very troublesome aspect. Takiya has its roots and its justification both in the Quran and also most importantly in the Hadith. It means that whenever it's advisable for a Muslim to hide his true intentions, to lie, to swear false oaths, etc., in his own interest and in the interest of Islam, it is either advised, he's advised to do so, or he's mandated, he's ordered to do so. Of course, this doesn't mean that any Muslim lies, but it means you can never know. And it goes very far. A Muslim is welcome to say that he's converted to Christianity. He is welcome to swear a false oath in court. He can do anything he wants. You can never be sure that he speaks the truth. And of course, when that is the basic culture, that is very serious for us, because in a Christian culture, we try to bring up our children to speak the truth, which doesn't mean that they always do. We don't do that all the time. But when we lie, we know we've committed a wrong. That is not the case in Islam. You simply do not have that. You do not have a bad conscience if you lie. Also, if you take another thing, why are Muslims always, I would say, a burden, an economic burden on the host societies? Very simple. They are not allowed to participate in the upkeep of non-Muslims. They are the ones who have a basic right to own our land, because the world as such belongs to Allah. And as there are non-Muslims, that is really an offense to Islam, because every person is born a Muslim. So that if there are non-Muslims, they have deviated from the line. They are heretics, they're sinners, and they can be killed. Mm-hmm. So they have absolutely no obligation to participate in the upkeep of our state, our public order, the rule of law, the welfare state, anything. I'm not saying that every Muslim behaves that way, but that is the ideology, and the ideology, of course, exerts and must exert a great influence, especially in a situation where this is the policy, this is the line that's preached by the imams.
Exactly.
I've never heard of any imam who said anything else.
The great historian, Mr. Bernard Lewis, he holds the thought that one of the reasons why Islam is in such a bad state and is so aggressive right now is because they feel inferior, and they feel bad because they have lost the race of civilization to the West. What's your thought on that?
Yes, I know his views on that. I'm not sure I agree entirely. It is true that it's an embarrassment to Islam to be so far behind. They used to think of themselves as the leading civilization in the world, and now they can't produce a bottle of beer or a camera or a toilet seat or anything. And all they can produce really is oil and dates and feta cheese. So of course that's an embarrassment. But they would always be aggressive. It is inherent in that ideology to conquer the world. It's simply an obligation. If a Muslim wants to get into heaven or paradise, he must, with his person, participate in the jihad. He does not have to be violent. He doesn't have to be a soldier. He doesn't have to necessarily detonate bombs. But he must, with his personal life, participate in the subjection of the non-Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say, well, it comes in waves sometimes. Islam has been subjected by force of arms several times in history, especially after the second failed attempt to conquer Vienna. There was a couple of centuries of reflection, self doubt, you could say. But as soon as there's any feasible means of re-engaging in the jihad, they will do it. As long as the basic ideology does not change. It hasn't changed for 1400 years, and that is a very interesting thing. We in the West cannot we have a hard time understanding a culture that does not change, that has an essence which remains the same over 1400 years, a core that is unchangeable. There have been a few attempts to change this core of Islam, mainly in the 9th century, by a group of philosophers called the Mu'tazilites. But of course they lost the battle, and you could say that since around 900, there's been no successful attempt to change anything. Even those that we consider to be intellectuals, and who have a standing in our culture, for example, Ibn Khaldun, basically stated that it is the objective of Islam to conquer the world, and therefore it must wage jihad until final victory is achieved.
I had a very troubling experience a few months ago in my gym. And in the gym there is a lot of different nationalities, and there are also some young Muslim boys. And I just overheard a discussion, and they said that and that really troubled me. 40% of the girls in their club have been raped. I think that is true.
Raped by whom?
By some of the boys.
They were victims. I don't know if Muslim boys that raped Muslim girls.
They said it was a club, so I don't even know exactly if it's Muslim girls or Danish girls. Mm-hmm. But it just 40%. It's a very large number.
Yes, indeed.
And I'm just, this is it's just a little flake of what happens around. We know that some very ugly things happen. We only hear some of it. But we know that things are happening that is very bad. Why do we allow this to happen?
Well, I don't know, because I would say, a self-hatred in our culture. Our leaders in the West basically don't think that our culture is worth defending. They think it's worthless. There's a deeply ingrained sense that we are doomed, that we are the true sinners. We are responsible for anything that happens in the world. Any evil you can think of is basically our fault. Think of the recent climate circus. People in Bangladesh who have been breeding children like nobody's business, and who have chopped down the trees so they have these floodings, etc. They keep saying it's our fault. I haven't been to Bangladesh, nor have I fathered any children there. But it's our fault, and our leaders basically accept that. Yes, we are to blame. We have to make amends. Also, we cannot conceive of a culture that's still based on slavery, because that's what it is. When a Muslim man rapes a woman, it is his right to do so. It is a part of slavery. A Muslim man can have, as you know, unless he's a prophet, he can have four wives. And then he can have an unlimited number of slaves, female slaves, on the side. Muslim had slaves, as opposed to, for example, Jesus, who had no slaves. a loose woman, a woman who is not under the protection or the guidance of her guardian, is basically free to be raped. If she moves around in the city without any guardian, you can freely rape her. She's your slave. Of course, they would. We have many examples, and I mentioned Sweden here, I think it's probably the most prominent example of this in the West, where Swedish girls are raped, gang raped, etc., etc. There's nothing wrong in it, viewed from an Islamic perspective. This is your right. You are even obliged to do that.
But then again, to know that your own children are raped and still not doing anything about it, how can that be? I mean, on a higher ethical level than the doesn't make sense. I mean,
but they rape their own children.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear that all the time, that girls in Muslim families are raped by their uncles or their cousins or their father. There was a recent book that came out in Norway, written by a Somalian girl. It was called Notice Us, where she talks about conditions in Somali families in Norway. She was raped by her uncle. Her mother and her mother's friends and her father made no protest. Women are basically, how could I describe it, they have no value. They're not human beings. They have a function as wombs. They bear the offspring of the warriors in order to create new warriors. Other than that, they can be used for sexual purposes, but they have no value, no human value.
Hans Christian Andersen, the great Danish fairy tale maker, he has this story about the emperor and his clothes.
Yes.
And everybody says that the emperor has very beautiful clothes on, even though he does not have it. Is this one of the psychological principles that's working in the Western civilization or in the deeds of the Western civilization concerning these things?
Well, who's wearing the clothes or not wearing them? In
because everybody says, well, Islam is not a problem, right? And if you get into the case, you can see that Islam is a problem, but you're not allowed to say it because then you get out of the social accepted circles and stuff. So.
Well, I think if your assembly has any value, any use in this context, I'd say that the ones who are not wearing any clothes are the ones that we have appointed as our so-called experts. Those who make their living in the universities, in the think tanks, etc., and also journalists, those whose business it is to know what's going on, and who don't even look. These are the ones who are wearing no clothes. And I would predict that if we ever wake up, these characters are in for a very rude awakening, when it turns out that everything they've been saying was a lie. They didn't know their business, and if they did know their business, they certainly did not tell the population where it was at. For example, I got if you'll excuse me for just a second, almost cut it out. I got a mail from a Muslim friend of mine who talked about the Hijra, the yearly meet in Mecca for the Ramadan or whatever, right? Millions of people go there. He said, well, he had been there. Women were raped, molested. Nobody washed themselves. People's stuff was stolen. There was violence. And don't tell me that all of these hundreds of journalists from CNN and other outlets who go there, don't tell me they don't know about this. They're simply not reporting it. They're reporting it as a very elevated and very holy event, showing how deeply religious these people are. But I must say, I have nothing but respect for these journalists and these so-called experts, whose job it is to investigate, tell us the truth, and who lie through their teeth. And that is, I think, is the basic problem. Anyone who looks into the real matter, the real history, of course, is exposed as a xenophobic, racist, fascist, and you know the rest. Fortunately, I had the sense that more and more people are coming around, because the explanation of the expert simply makes no sense. Makes no sense. Why is it that, of course, we've had waves upon waves of immigrants from other cultures that came to, for example, Denmark, and who have integrated very well. Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese, South Americans. We've had waves of Jews, etc., etc. And they have presented absolutely no problem. The first generation might have had some problems integrating. You know, they're from any country, you know, from the U.S., etc. The second generation fits in very well. Learn the language, and it doesn't make any difference what they look like or what their names are. They are very good citizens. Why is it that the longer Muslims have stayed in the country, the less integrated they become? How can you explain that? I mean, to me, that was my starting point, looking into Islam. As you said, I'm a historian by training, so I wonder. I start thinking about things. And in my case, it started out in the late 90s, where I said, well, what's happening here? Now we've had a vast influx of Muslims for 3 or 4 decades, and they become less and less integrated. What's the explanation? In order to get to the explanation, of course, you have to look at the core values of the civilization within which they are brought up and which is upheld by their local leaders.
Mm-hmm. Well, then how do we change it? How do we fight this war?
Well, the only thing we can do is to take energetic steps to impede the ability of imams to influence their flock. They should not be given the courtesy of being invited to the government for consultations. They represent nobody. They have not been elected to anything. Anyone can call himself an imam, and if you can get $1 million from Saudi Arabia and set up a mosque in some basement or some place, he can call himself an imam, and he can claim to be taken seriously. We ought to close mosques where imams preach non-integration, hatred of the West, where imams preach that girls who don't want to wear the hijab should be beaten, Jews should be nailed to the cross and bleed to death in 3 days, as we've seen in England, etc., etc. Homosexuals ought to have a wall tumbled down upon them, or have to be thrown up from mountains, etc. It's even against our constitution to allow that. The Danish constitution does not allow you, does not permit you to say anything in the name of religion. And we ought to put our foot down and say, well, this is where it stops. Mm-hmm. You're quite welcome to have your mosques. You're quite welcome to pray to your God in whichever way you want, but within the limits of the Danish Constitution, which says in its Article 67 that we have religion, freedom of religion, provided that nothing be taught nor undertaken in contravention of of morality and the public order. Simple as that.
Mm.
Our leaders do not take this seriously, and I'm afraid that it will take a public uproar, public uprising, before they start taking this seriously. But they must. It's their obligation. And I would say that after the German occupation in 1945, you know, there was quite a few of those who had collaborated with the enemy got into very hot water. I would assume or suspect the same thing could happen here to those whose job and whose obligation it was to protect the populations and who did not do it, but who paved the way for their enemies.
So you're saying that actually that the consequences for the ones in power right now are very dire and actually playing a very dangerous game for themselves?
I'd say so. They could also be dire for us because they could win. It's absolutely possible that Islam could win. It's been looking like that for quite a few years. I'm not so sure now, but it is either or. It cannot be resolved by a compromise. It's either our civilization or their non-civilization or their barbarism. And those who have helped and aided them, aided and abetted, of course, will have to explain themselves at some future point. They will not be spared, by the way. I mean, any non-believer will, non-believers will not be spared, even if they paved the way. They will suffer the same fate as the rest of us, unless they convert, of course, which I suspect that many will do.
Well, so this is a way we can fight it, but what are we fighting for? What is the principles of our civilization which we are holding dear and which is very important to us?
It's very simple. Our civilization is not without its faults. It has all kinds of faults, shortcomings that you can imagine. Basically, to keep what we have. Basically, to understand that it has taken us 2,500 years to create the civilization that we have. We've been all through all kinds of problems. Dictatorship, Holocaust, wars, barbarism, religious fanaticism, etc., etc. We've overcome that. We've become stronger for that. Basically, our civilization is based on the notion of freedom, personal choice, free speech, the value of the individual person, equality of sexes, the right of anyone to change his religion or have no religion, the love of children, our sense that new things are happening in the world and that it's a good thing that new things are happening, that you can invent new things, you can think new thoughts. And these two latter things, of course, are also forbidden. In Islam, any novelty is evil, which is why they don't invent anything. They don't think new thoughts. New thoughts are an abomination, because everything that's worth thinking has been thought 1,400 years ago. It was God who thought it, so who can beat that? So our two ways of life are like fire and water. One of them must be victorious, and the other one must be defeated. It could be us, or it could be them.
So let's hope it will be us.
I hope so.